Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
So after the war, as Alex said, he spent this time down in Zion, and then he came back and worked at the Improvement Era. And there he met John A. Widso. And Widso had prided himself in kind of being the mentor and a person who knew all the young scholars, the academics that might help the church. And so he got to know Widso really well and worked with him there at the Improvement Era. And Widso wrote to then president of BYU, Howard McDonald, and said, "You need to get this guy down there." And at the bottom of the letter, he actually wrote something about how we need to keep this guy for our use. It was very Machiavellian.
Mm-hmm.
But he got him an interview with McDonald, and he started teaching there. At the same time, he published Response. Fawn Brody had published her biography of Joseph Smith called No Man Knows My History, and Brody, of course, took a very naturalistic view of Joseph Smith, and so Hugh wrote this piece called No Ma'am, That's Not History, and kind of very jokingly, horse-laughingly kind of playing with her title and his book. It was just a pamphlet.
Yeah, now, was he on assignment to write that?
He just did that himself. There were things he wanted to do, but he just chose to do that one. And it garnered him a great deal of interest, of course, in the church. A lot of people saw him as coming to the defense of the church. A lot of people in Mormon culture, you know, the internet wasn't there, so they would read Nibley's piece, but very few of them actually read Brody. And so it served as a great way of keeping people from, you know, leaving the church over the Joseph Smith story. And it established him as, you know, this chief apologist, and we can get into that later. But I think even more than that, it established the Book of Mormon as something that became really prominent in Mormon culture. Prior to that, the Book of Mormon really hadn't been taken very seriously. You found very few references in conference talks even. Among general authorities, and all of a sudden, Hugh Nibley starts talking about this, and soon after No Ma'am, That's Not History, he publishes a series in the Improvement Era about the Book of Mormon, trying to situate that within an ancient world framework.
And, so this is Lehi in the desert, world of Jaredites, okay.
World of Jaredites, and later there would be Jaredites. So by the 1960s, he's publishing pretty much monthly in the Improvement Era. And then these would come out in book form later and really kind of established himself as a you know, defender of the faith through the 60s and 70s.
Now, let me interrupt you for a second here. He also published, I mean, and again, we're going to deal with this more, but he published, you know, in regular journals and things like that. Wasn't there some point where he says, you know, they accepted everything I published, it, you know, nothing was important, it was basically like, let's get a pile of accolades for our obituaries, and so it was like, I think it might have been Kevin Barney who's going to join us for the next segment, maybe it was his summary, but I don't know if he got it from somewhere else, it was like, well, this is how I fulfill my temple covenants. This is how I consecrate my gifts for the service of the church. Is there something consciously in that?
Well, in the 1960s, he took a sabbatical to Berkeley. And I think this was a huge turning point. He had published quite a bit in academic journals outside of Mormon culture. And that sabbatical, I think, He doesn't really talk a lot about what happened there, but I think he really caught on to the idea that academics was a kind of game. He really started to see things that he didn't like in academic politics. And then he came home to BYU in the middle of a huge controversy in the religion department at that time about whether the Book of Mormon should be one of the required courses. And it was a kind of comical debate, because the people who were in favor of the Book of Mormon being used in courses at BYU were all rabid anti-communist, right-wing John Bircher types. And then the more liberal professors, which they actually had at that time, were people who were in favor of having a kind of main doctrinal ideas of Mormonism, more of a philosophical, theological class that was the core. And Hugh was, interestingly, in the middle of this debate, because on the one hand, he wanted the Book of Mormon as the core class, but he very much didn't agree with the conservative viewpoint. And so he was in the middle of this debate that he found very silly. And so I think that was a real turning point for him, where all of his scholarship after that pretty much focused on more of the apologetics and, Mormon issues.
Okay. So he's now teaching at BYU. Probably, you can tell me when the big followings and when he became the kind of the cult figure. But let's at least have him meet Phyllis,
his wife. Back to that one. That's a wonderful story. The big concern that BYU had about Hugh when he started there was that he was single. So he would have been 36 years old, as Brigham Young would have called him, a certifiable menace, right? And so they were very concerned that he was single. And he had been engaged two times or three times, Alex?
Good question. He said he proposed to Anahita Iscarian, but she never got the word on that. She didn't get the memo that she'd been proposed to.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
He probably did it in some language she couldn't read, right?
I don't know. But he had a few interests, and at least one formal engagement.
Yeah. So he had engaged, but he never got married. And so he gets to BYU, and he told the story. He says that he made a promise that he would marry the first girl he met at BYU. He walked into the housing office, and the housing office secretary was also the French department secretary, and that was Phyllis. And he walked in to get housing, and she met him. And, of course, he decided right there that was the woman he was going to marry. And he started after that coming back into the office from time to time to borrow 3x5 note cards. And she would try to give him a big stack, but he'd only take a few at a time because he kept wanting to come back, I guess.
Nice. I do remember this. Yeah.
Actually, he asked her to a picnic, a family picnic, and then they'd take long walks together. But it was about a month, if I'm remembering correctly, before they got engaged. And sure enough, he did end up marrying the first woman he met at BYU.
Awesome. Well, great. And 8 kids came along the way pretty much on time. Alex, was there any struggle getting pregnant, or were there any miscarriages or things in the way?
Yeah, I was born after my mother was not supposed to get pregnant again, certainly not soon, and there was doubt about whether she would be able to have any more children, although I ended up being the 5th of 8. But there was one that was stillborn at, I believe, 5 months before me.
Okay, all right.
And they never, of course, they never named the child, but Hugh and Phyllis, as I understand it, always agreed that the name would have been Isaac.
Yeah.
In the Faith of an Observer, Hugh tells a beautiful story about Abraham and encountering the strangers who come to his tent and prophesy the birth of Isaac. And it's at that point he tears up. And I can't help but think about the fact that they had lost this child, this lost Isaac. That happened that would have been what,
54? 54, yeah, it would have happened in 54.
Yeah.
Okay. Now let's do this. At the end, when we kind of talk, we'll kind of get a better flavor for Hugh as family man, if that works for you guys.
Yeah.
So let's just now head, just a real brief sketch, Boyd, of his long career at BYU, and maybe just a quick highlights of some of the special side callings that he would get from the brethren to teach them some things.
Very early on, he started publishing. He called them G2 reports. A G2 report in the military were these intelligence reports that they would publish in military intelligence, and so he would create these G2 reports that he would deliver to general authorities on certain topics, evolution or, you know, Book of Mormon or some.
Were they invited by them?
It's hard to say. I never really saw an invitation, but evidently they were welcomed. And then occasionally general authorities would ask about a topic. I found a letter from Spencer W. Kimball asking about the shining stones in Jaredite boats. And a few months later, Hugh had written this essay called Strange Ships and Shining Stones, which addressed that was published in the Improvement Era. So he's publishing regularly in the Improvement Era. He's teaching a wide variety of classes at BYU, not only in the religion department, but he's teaching languages, Greek and Russian and other languages. I think a couple of side things that are really interesting. He was very interested in the book side of studying, the very academic side, but he was always interested in the practical side too, and experiencing things. And he began visiting the Hopis down in the Southwest, and going to their ritual dances and developing relationships with some of the Hopis. There's a wonderful story he told about traveling with President Kimball. There was a time when Ernest Wilkinson was trying to beef up enrollments at BYU by asking professors to travel with general authorities. It's hard to believe today that they'd need enrollments, but they did at the time. And so Hugh would travel with Spencer W. Kimball. And at one of their stops, he had stopped just before they were supposed to get on a train, and Hugh told the story about how he had stopped at a bookstore and was almost late to get the train and had to run to catch up. And when he gets there, he gets in his seat sitting next to President Kimball, and his shoes were all dusty from having run all that way. And he says President Kimball bent over and just wiped his shoes. And he found that such a touching act. Again, you know, Hugh was never illusioned by thinking general authorities were somehow superhuman or, you know, were talking with Jesus daily. But I think he developed a great love for general authorities and they developed a great deal of trust with him. We can talk later about some of the ways he articulated both the apologetic message and the social criticism. The other thing I think is interesting is he fit into this, as you mentioned earlier, he fit into this place in the 1960s, late 50s, 1960s, into the 70s, of really, you know, a strange hybrid. On the one hand, he was defending the church, but on the other hand, his politics was so different. He published an article about the unresolved loyalty problems during the McCarthy hearings, in which he talked about loyalty oaths in ancient cultures, and
right.
Obviously was comparing them to loyalty oaths in the modern world. Later he published a piece after Spiro Agnew came to BYU and delivered a talk. He published a piece that actually followed it in BYU Studies when Spiro Agnew's talk was published. Really decrying the way rhetoric had replaced solid arguments in politics. There were a couple of times when he and Sterling McMurrin had these debates that were, it would be fascinating to be able to go back and witness these. I guess they were hugely attended. They did one at BYU and one at the U of U, where they would just take very different positions and argue them. One of the things that I find most exciting about Hugh is that he valued difference. Most of his closest friends were people who were so different from him. Springer was a very conservative, Nazi sympathizing bootlegger, and and Hugh was this very liberal, straight-laced Mormon, and they were just really close friends. And then, you know, he had other friends who were just so different, and I find that really interesting and refreshing that he valued that kind of conversation.
When did he become a cult figure? When, you know, we don't need to necessarily go into the mythology, but he became, you know, larger than life somewhere along the line. About what time would that be?
Well, like I say, I think during the 50s and 60s, those articles were appearing monthly in the Improvement era. And, I mean, it was just a regular thing. He was part of that institution.
Okay.
And so he developed this following both at BYU and within the church. And then in 1957,
The priesthood manual, for sure.
To do the priesthood manual. It's a strange manual by today's standards because, again, it's a very academic tone.
It's called An Approach to the Book of Mormon, right?
An Approach to the Book of Mormon. And, he's taking this very ancient historical view, trying to put Lehi in this ancient world and, setting him up in this ancient milieu and arguing that he's a representative man of that culture. And, David O. McKay asked him to do it, and evidently the reading committee vetoed him on every chapter. They were very upset. This was too erudite for the average member. Nobody's going to understand this. And President McKay said, no, let him stretch, and overruled the committee.
Awesome.
So I think by that time he had this reputation that, he couldn't go anywhere without people noticing that he was Hugh Nibley. He was kind of this local celebrity. In one letter I found, it was kind of funny. He said he was driving to Canada. Obviously, this must have been in the 60s, but he was driving up to attend a meeting in Canada, and he got to the border, and he didn't have his passport. And he was very worried, how am I going to get over here? I don't have any ID. And the person at the border was a Mormon and recognized him immediately and let him right through.
Oh, man, that's interesting.
So I think, he gained a certain notoriety that was really quite almost cult-like in Mormon circles.
And then, of course, you throw in the eccentricities, the way he would dress, the disheveledness, the complete lack of, he's the prototypical absent-minded professor, iconoclast, would you say? That certainly feeds legends and cults.
Absolutely. I think the cross between the way he dressed and Alex can talk a little bit about that, but I think a cross between that and his outlandish statements. I mean, in a BYU graduation ceremony, he was asked to give the prayer, and he talks about the black robes of a false priesthood and these kind of things that seem so completely, out of character for somebody who's, supposed to be the defender of the faith. So outlandish that kind of created a folklore, and so he became the person everybody told stories about. The first chapter of my book, I deal with the folklore of Hugh Nibley, and the problem with it is that it's really hard to separate the fact from the folklore with him, because he really was very eccentric, and he really did say some pretty eccentric things, and sometimes when I'd ask him about whether a story was true, he didn't always know. There's a wonderful story that Elder Oaks told about how he had heard that on Hugh's mission, the ward had taken up a collection to buy a missionary a new suit. And Hugh figured, well, if he needed a new suit, he probably needed a hat too. So he chipped in an extra bunch, so he probably gave the biggest contribution. And then it turned out that the suit and hat were for him. Because he was the disheveled missionary that they were trying
to do.
And I asked Hugh if that story was true. And the first time I asked him, he said, no, that couldn't be true. And then he says, well, yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think it might have been true. So he couldn't even remember. So it was really difficult. But a lot of those stories, you know, really aren't true, but some of them should be.
Yeah, there you go. Definitely. Well, good. And he was at least at BYU, certainly slowing down his teaching, but right up to the last couple of years before his death, or even longer.
Yeah, he officially retired in the 70s. I forget the exact year, but maybe Alex can help me with this one, too.
That's right. I was bumping into him in the ancient studies reading room and would have been late 80s. Yeah, and he definitely was retired by then.
He kept teaching at least part-time into the 90s.
Yeah.
Okay.
Late 90s.
Yeah, late 90s he was still teaching, and he maintained an office there, and so he'd go up every day and work right up until just a few years before he passed away.
Okay. Yeah. And along the way, you know, Farms was formed, and eventually one of their main projects early on was the collected works of Hugh Nibley, and so it ended up being 13 volumes, is that right?
To 19 now.
It's up to 19, and that includes the one internal round and stuff like that. They've continued to number those, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, so he you know, certainly influenced this generation of apologists and things like this, and so much so that everything that had been published through the years and scattered throughout were all gathered together and edited into this matching set, and certainly that's out there for anybody to encounter right now. So just an amazing, remarkable amount of scholarship and defense of the faith and modeling certain things. Half of his fans were probably from his radical social commentary, and half were from his, you know, hey, Mormonism and the things we do has ancient roots. Yay, I can, you know, go forward with trust, that kind of thing. So it's probably just the most diverse fan base out there.
Yeah, exactly.
If anything else comes up about his BYU career, please do. But as I mentioned before, Alex, why don't we move a little bit? I'd like a flavor of Hugh as a dad. Family life, what's it like to be a Nibley growing up, your interactions, but mostly just Hugh as a dad and a parent. And then we can transition into one of the sad chapters of his life, some accusations and things that came up at the end of his life. And we'd love to hear this from you, what you think's going on there or not.
Sure.
So, yeah, just riff. Love it. Thanks.
Just riff. Okay. Well, dad as a dad, it's complex. You know, as with everything else, the man was enormously complex. I remember as early memories are just how much fun he was. I mean, you know, climbing all over. We used him like a piece of playground equipment, you know, as kids will do.
Nice.
And he played along with us, always taking us swimming, taking us on jaunts, you know. He tended to walk to school. We lived right off campus, and our playground was the campus, and we would run into him all the time. And he was very childlike in a lot of ways, and so we could identify with him as a child. That lasted up until about the time we got into grade school, and then it became then he became harder to relate to. You know, in talking about that, there were 8 different experiences of being Hugh Nibley's child, and I can only speak about one of them, and not very well, really, in a lot of ways. But, you know, things that I remember were reading bedtime stories. Our bedtime stories would be Shakespeare. That is, everybody was divided up parts, and we read Hamlet. I didn't know what the heck I was reading, but
awesome.
You know, we were reading Hamlet. We were reading Twelfth Night, and then he read us the entire Odyssey out of a huge leather-bound volume. And I remember sitting on the floor looking up, and I could see, I think it said 1565 printed out across the back of it in gold letters on this huge leather-bound volume, and it was written in Greek. And he translated as he went along.
Oh, man, interesting.
And it was a wonderful translation. And I and understand, we never thought of this as culture, okay? it was cool stories as far as we were concerned. I mean, they were gouging a guy's eyeball out with a big pole that Odysseus was standing on top of, and the blood was boiling up around it. And oh man, that was, you know, it was R-rated stuff. It was cool, you know. And he was a lot of fun with that. And always, you know, reading together was an enormous thing. When I was a teenager, and my younger sisters, it looked for a while like we were going to spend a semester abroad in France. So I started taking French in high school, and then Dad decided he didn't want to be leading any tours, so he canceled that, and there I was in French. But one of the things that happened there was that we began reading these French kind of what we would call a graphic novel now. They were like comic books, the Astérix, the Gaulois, which are these great French books that are picture books, but they have a lot of history. They happened at the time of Julius Caesar, and we would read them in French and translate them together or you know, get wade through the French together. And, you know, constantly the jaunts and the discussions. You didn't say anything without being prepared to defend it in our house.
Nice.
If you made a statement, if you said it's a nice day today, you'd better have evidence. And you'd better be ready to stand your ground and defend it. And that was, I think, maybe the greatest blessing he ever gave me was that he never gave me a straight answer to a question. You know, I would go and ask him, you know, what about this? You know, what about something I had read? And he said, well, you know, Thucydides said this about it, and you can go look it up. And I said, and he'd give you the book. I said, Dad, it's in Greek. He said, well, it's very easy Greek.
Yeah, I remember you telling that story before. That's so awesome. Yeah.
So there were downsides too. I mean, he was a public figure. The first time I defied him and went face to face with him, I was 17 years old. And I resigned from family home evenings. I said, I'm not coming anymore. Because what was happening was that our family home evenings had become a weekly fireside.
Oh, right.
Filled with various BYU students and taggers on and anybody visiting from out of town. And the family would sit there and we'd sit there and roll our eyes and, you know, it had nothing to do with the family. I said, I'm not coming anymore. And I told Mom, and she said, well, you got to tell your father. Uh-oh. I'd never faced down Hugh Nibley. I never told him to his face that he was wrong or that I wasn't going to do something he told me to do. But I did, and he didn't blast me on the spot. He wasn't pleased with it, but, you know, he dealt with it. But also the fact that he was so much involved with his intellectual work meant that the real operation of the family either got passed on to Mom or else it didn't happen. So there was a lot of, with a lot of the fun and the intellectual stuff that went on, and we always had great books and stuff. Never had a TV in the house when I was growing up. That didn't happen until after I'd grown up and moved out. But along with that, there was chaos. There was, he's not somebody to hand to go to with, you know, your problems of puberty.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we struggled through that as best we could. And there's a Freudian slip, as best we can. I guess some of us are, well, all of us are probably still struggling with that on some level or another. But also in the discussion of Dad, you can't really talk about him without acknowledging that nothing he could have done in his life could he have done without the women in his life. First of all, his grandmother, who gave him this deep sense of spirituality that sustained him through his life. And secondly, his wife, who made it possible for him to have this remarkable career that he had that, was... You know, he lived pretty much in the clouds, and every now and then he'd come down and visit us. But,
right.
You know,
Yay, Phyllis. How is your mom doing?
She's still active. She lives alone, on her own, but she lives just up the street from my brother, who, you know, checks in on her a lot, and she's still very much involved with a lot of the stuff that we've been doing. We haven't mentioned in this podcast, but we've got a blog, the hughnibley.net, where you can read a lot of these letters. The letter that Boyd was talking about going to Canada and forgetting his passport. We've posted some excerpts of that, and there's a lot of fun stuff on there. And we're also getting involved in a lot of, as I mentioned before, electronic publishing. As you said, there's a generation now that really doesn't understand him and hasn't really been introduced to him. And we want to make him available for a more wired generation and for a generation that's more electronically hooked in. So we spent some time working with Deseret Book. We've now finalized an agreement whereby we're going to be able to publish many of his essays in ebook form and in enhanced ebook form, which means we'll be able to include multimedia, video clips, things like that, that will add context and interest to the essays and we believe make them not just available, but make them really exciting for the next generation of Nibley fans.
Neat. Well, good luck. More power to it, and keep us in the loop, and I'll see what I can do to keep it in front of our listeners. All right, Alex, if you're ready, let's go into the final segment, which we planned, and just as a way of briefly introducing it to our listeners. Towards the end of Hugh's life, probably just the last couple of years, one of his daughters, Martha Nibley Beck, began to make claims that at a time when she was young, that she was ritually abused by her father, molested. It had religious overtones and things like this, and of course this came at the same time that so many claims like this were emerging all over. Recovered memory hypnosis sessions and things like this were creating a phenomenon of people saying, you know, there's these blank parts in my life or there's these spots that I can't fill in. And through hypnosis, they begin to fill it in. And what emerges is that there was a lot of sense of being violated, often by people who were trustworthy, religious leaders, and things like this. And so within this milieu of this time, Martha, quite a few years, you know, sort of past the heyday of that, said, this is what's happened to me, and she began to make these accusations. They ended up in a book that she wrote called Leaving the Saints. Alex, if you don't mind just telling the story from the family perspective, where does the story stand now? What's the basic way that it's seen and interpreted out there? And if you don't mind, I'll just let you go however you'd like. Thanks.
Sure. Well, you know, let me tell the story from a personal point of view, how I experienced it. In the early 90s, I'd been living in Guam for 4 years and was not very much in touch with what was going on in the family. I moved to Los Angeles. I'd gone through a divorce myself, and I began to hear a lot of stuff that had been going on in the family. At the same time, I became familiar with a lot of the stuff that was going along on in the kind of pop psychology world. A lot to do with recovered memory and recovered memories of abuse, and particularly sexual molestation. And at a certain point, I realized that I went and I talked to Martha. Now, I should say, in regards to the controversy with Martha, I am the only person that has interviewed and investigated in depth. I've interviewed every single person who was involved directly with the conflict, including Martha and including Hugh. And I've asked all of them direct questions, and I got the answers that have satisfied me. When I heard that Martha had come to the conclusion that Dad had raped her when she was a child, I did not immediately decide that she was wrong. You know, I was upset. I was saddened by it. I had been reading The Pop Psychology about recovered memory, and I was fairly convinced that it was accurate, that it was for real. I went and talked to Martha, and she talked to me about it, and I went back and, you know, the Roseanne Barr stuff was coming out, and I examined my own life, and, you know, had I been molested? And I did have a memory of being molested by a BYU student when I was young, and I tried to figure out how that was the reason that I had any other problems in my life. And after several months of that, I figured that, no, that wasn't the reason I had other problems. I talked to Martha, and she said that she told me, oh boy, how can I make this short? Because it gets very long and complex. Martha accused Dad of having molested her. And as a consequence of that, she did not want to reveal that to Dad at the time I talked to her. And I said, you know, why don't you talk to him if this is what happened? I've read the literature. You're supposed to confront your abuser, all this kind of stuff. He doesn't know why you're not talking to him. And she said, well, I have to work on my inner child and stuff. So I said, well, you need to get that done, and this needs to be cleared up. And if this is true, then he needs to go to prison, you know, and you need to get it over with. And I was prepared to go there. If that's where it went, I was prepared to go there. After that, a lot of things began to come out where, and again, trying to make a long story short, but I became convinced that whether or not Martha had actually been molested, in the telling of her story, she was not telling the truth. There were things that she was telling in her version that she told me that she had never told to other people. And then we found out that, you know, her therapist had actually literally written the book on how to do self-hypnosis, right. And had actually lost her license and all this kind of stuff. All this kind of stuff came out. So eventually, we thought that, you know, Martha had kind of moved on. But then as Dad was declining, Martha had a contract that she had signed with Random House for three books, maybe it was for two books. This is information I got from her ex-husband, and it was a big contract, and it was based on the success of Expecting Adam, which was also a memoir. So she had written the first book for this contract. It was a multi-book contract. She wrote the first one, and it didn't do well. And so she needed something that was, you know, had the same energy as Expecting Adam. So we got the word. It was just before Thanksgiving. I was out riding my bike. I got a call from my sister Christine. She says, we got a problem. Martha's going to put this book out. And eventually it came out, and it happened, you know, at the time that Dad actually died. One of the very last conversations I had with Dad was an interview that I did with him. Now, I'll reveal this to your listeners for the first time, that I did interview Hugh Nibley in depth about the specific accusations that are made in Leaving the Saints. I interviewed him on camera, and I have that tape. To be honest with you, I've never looked at it, but I know what's on there because I remember it well. Here's what goes on in my mind when I think about the Martha process, because on one level, on a subjective level, it's so deeply painful to me because I love my sister Martha, you know, and her loss is a devastating hole in my heart. But I know beyond any shadow of a doubt that her book is a lie front to back. Now, this is the thing that's frustrating, is all these people who will come to us, and I still get them. I get emails in the last few weeks saying that Hugh Nibley is a black stain on the church because he's a child molester. And to this I say, you know, I was there. I know kind of what was going on in my house when I was a child. And they say, no, you don't really know what happened. People who try to tell you what your life is, that's a very painful experience.
Right.
To have people try to tell you that your lies that your life is false, because I know what my life is, and people have asked me from time to time, well, can you prove that he did not molest her? Look, that's proving a negative, right? I cannot prove that Ronald Reagan did not rape Martha Beck. I can't prove a negative, you know? I just can't. But here's something I can prove, absolutely, okay? I can prove that Martha's book, Leaving the Saints, from top to bottom, is built on falsehood. Now the question becomes, how many lies do I have to tell you? How many lies do I have to prove absolutely with empirical evidence before we can say, yes, Martha's a liar? What I come down to, Dan, is this. Anybody who has paid any real attention to this subject knows that Martha was lying. Okay? We know that. She lied about her life. She lied about her reputation. She lied about her credentials. She lied about her family, all kinds of stuff. The book, top to bottom, is false. But it's very frustrating for me because people continue to say, oh, yeah, well, you're just saying that because you're defending the church. Listen, go out there and show me anything that I have said publicly or in print where I am a defender of the faith. I'm not my dad. I'm not a defender of the faith. There are not only that, but there are more than half the children in the Nibley household left the church before Martha did. Okay? Now, that's one of the big lies she tells, of course, is that she's the one who went out into the world and went to a liberal school where she, you know, learned this stuff that led her away from the church. Well, nonsense. And she knows that. Martha knows that perfectly well. First of all, she went to the school, same school George Bush went to, so let's not claim that as liberalism, okay? I went to the American Conservatory Theater in San Francisco, and I happen to know that it's Harvard, they at least wear clothes in class, you know. We didn't. In an acting school in San Francisco, we were wearing tights and whatnot, you know. But again, this question of being told that my life is false, it's annoying. Yeah. Another one of the huge lies that Martha tells is that she is trained in the discipline of psychology. It wasn't until a long time after, not a long time, but in the follow up after this controversy, I contacted her dissertation advisor at Harvard, and I said, "What psychological training did she have at Harvard?" She said, "None." She didn't take a single graduate course in psychology. Her ex-husband told me she had one surveyed undergraduate course in psychology. Now, based on this, in Leaving the Saints, she gives descriptions about how she's been trained to do psychological research. And based on this, she kidnaps a 90-year-old man, keeps him for several hours. This is a man who had an emergency visit to the hospital, a man who was a cancer survivor. She doesn't even give him a drink of water or let him go to the bathroom for many hours during which she holds him against his will. And according to her own description, puts him through the terror of being a prisoner of war. And so there was a lot of follow-up that we did. I mean, obviously, we were very angry and we were very hurt. And we tried to do what we could. I put together three different book proposals that were shopped around to several different publishers. One publisher put it most succinctly in an email to my agent when he wrote, "Martha Beck works for Oprah Winfrey, and it is the kiss of death for any publisher to publish anything that might embarrass Oprah Winfrey." Now, Martha's book, you know, Oprah Winfrey shamed James Fry for you know, writing a false memoir that she promoted. Many other false memoirs have been written, and the people have been shamed for it. The amount of falsehood in James Fry's book is minuscule compared to that in Martha's book. And anyone who has examined the book knows that.
Right. And let's just also broaden it. broaden it to Alex, just or and Boyd maybe kick in here. Anyone who's really examined the recovered memory thing, especially the ritualistic, religious overtone one, which was a piece of Martha's accusations that Hugh was wearing Egyptian masks and, you know, it was all part of an elaborate thing. Pretty much has there been anybody that's ever, like, has any of that ever stood the scrutiny?
No. Well, she's very, when she first related her story to me, she told it as a recovered memory. After, when she was writing this memoir, the whole recovered memory movement had been debunked. Her therapist had had her license taken away for doing exactly the kind of thing she did with Martha. Martha never disclosed that her therapist was this woman who had lost her license. A lot of people who were sent to prison were released,
right?
Because these laws were overturned. Martha stepped into this whole movement, and she stepped in with both feet. And here's one of the things that just breaks my heart, because, you know, as Martha describes herself, she is the one who had the courage to break away from the church and from the family. In reality, that was just the opposite. Martha was always the most conservative member of our family. When she was active in the church, she was by far the most devout. I mean, one of the enormous falsehoods of her books is that she fails to disclose that during the time she was at BYU, she wrote a book about how to deprogram yourself from being a homosexual. Okay? The book is called "Breaking the Cycle of Compulsive Behavior," and she never reveals that she never also reveals that both she and her husband at the time, John Beck, were both gay. They knew they were gay before they got married, and they together wrote this book on how to deprogram yourself from being gay. And now, of course, you will not find that on Martha's Beck's list of accomplishments, although the book was on the shelves until recently. Yeah, she stepped into this movement and she got caught up in it, as Martha was wont to do. Martha was always the greatest follower of trends and fads. The rest of the family tended to be far more rebellious. If you're in a room where everything's going one direction, my brothers and sisters, I can usually count on them to say, wait just a minute, I completely disagree with everybody in this room. And they would stand up and say that. I can see every one of my brothers and sisters doing that, except Martha. Martha's the one that so much needed the acclaim. She so much needed that feedback, that when she was at BYU, boy, she was the straightest arrow there was there. And once she left and acknowledged her homosexuality, as much as she has, at least, you know, the pendulum swung way the other direction. And the only way for her, I think, this is my own personal theory, my own, you know, amateur psychologizing, is that in order for her to break from the family, she had to do this enormous accusation and break. But, you know, she talks so much about being an evidence-based person, being empirical. What is the evidence? On one side, you have Martha's word, and she cites a number of people, but she won't give you their names. It has never been, she keeps calling herself doctor, but she's never written anything that was peer-reviewed. And she makes enormous accusations of criminal behavior. She accused me of being a criminal, of covering up for child abuse, which is a felony. On the other side, what do you have? You have 10 people who have notarized, signed affidavits that are admissible in a court of law. One of them, a deathbed affidavit signed by Hugh Nibley himself, that he did not molest Martha, that he wanted nothing but good for her. But I'll tell you, Dan, the one thing that convinced me in my investigating process, the thing that it convinced me most powerfully that Hugh Nibley was innocent of this. I began to believe that as I investigated more, that Martha's stories were changing as she told different people, and that she was lying. or at least embellishing the truth enormously. When she finally got ready to tell him what was going on, the first thing I did was I drove up from Los Angeles and I sat down with Dad face to face and I said, okay, this is the accusation that you molested Martha as a child. Is there any, could there be any kind of truth to this? Okay, now we're talking about a man here that, as far as I know, never told a lie in his life. I don't know of him ever. He could be a goofy son of a gun, okay? There are a lot of resentments that I could have against him, but I never heard him tell a lie, okay? And what was his response when I told him that he was about to be accused of raping a five-year-old child? He did not panic. He did not sweat. He did not look guilty. He did not make excuses. He looked at me and he said, oh, so it's okay. He was so relieved. Why? Because he realized that it wasn't something he had done. He was worried to death that something in the way he had raised Martha had led her into this alienation. But instead, he was so relieved when he found out that he was going to be accused of child molestation, because he realized that that was not something that he had actually done. And what I saw in his face was relief, not guilt. That was the strongest thing for me.
Thank you very much.
Zina went through the same process that Alex did, and I did too. I was working on the biography at the time these accusations were made, and we both took them very seriously. We both were just dumbfounded, we were living in the D.C. area at the time. Again, it was the same process. We started hearing the story differently, and it changed as she progressed through this. The thing that's really remarkable here to me is that Zina shared a room with Martha.
Right.
Zina has no memory of this. And incidentally, we were in marriage therapy at the time, and we had a therapist who tried to do hypnotherapy with us. And again, this was the 90s. That was the thing you did. And she never had any recovered memory of incest or anybody abusing her sister. The other thing that I'd emphasize is that I actually published this first. I sweated over this issue a long
time. In the biography, that's right.
In the biography. I didn't know what to do. Because I felt like if I said anything, it could, you know, it would be a big scandal. But if I didn't say anything, it would look like we were covering it up. And I did not want, you know, and the family agreed with me on this. I talked to every one of the brothers and sisters about what I should do on this. And all of them said, publish it. Make sure we're not hiding anything. And so it's on page 400 in the biography. That came out in 2003. And, you know, people often say that people don't make accusations about rape unless something really happened. Well, I have two responses to that. I know that something did happen, and it was with a neighbor, but it wasn't with her father. And I don't have time to go into that, but I know that something did happen. But I'd argue that there was a kind of psychological trauma, and I'm not a psychologist, I'm not trained here, but you know, anytime somebody has this kind of black and white thinking like Alex has described Martha having, and living in a culture where you have, you know, tendencies toward homosexual attraction, same-sex attraction, but you're living in a culture that's oppressing that, I think that's going to create tensions that can be really psychologically damaging. And so I don't blame Martha. I feel really sorry for her, and I hope that someday there can be reconciliation, but she's the one who's cut off the family, not the family cutting her off. And it, you know, I think we all have to agree in the family that her book really, that there were so many inconsistencies there. Once she started looking at it, it really made it very difficult to believe.
Thank you for that extra stuff. Boy, what a low note to leave a fascinating conversation with. But thank you both for your generosity and spending all this time and being so articulate and just introducing so many people. I think this will be their first real introduction to Hugh, and I hope they get a sense of the amazing scope of his life and work and influence. And please come back for segment two, which is going to be more on his scholarship and his arguments and things defending the church and at least ancient roots and parallels, and then finally his social criticism. So, Alex, thanks so much for being on.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
Great. And Boyd, we'll see you in segment two.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Thanks, my friends. Take care. Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.